Welcome to the Astrea Radio Show. The Astrea Radio Show is brought to you by www.astreamagazine.com. Our distinguished guest is Tom Harper. In 1957, Tom began his career as an Anglican priest at St. Margaret's in the Pines at West Hill, Ontario. That was from 1957 to 1964. And then, in 1964, he became Professor of New Testament at University of Toronto at the Toronto School of Theology. Tom Harper is listed in the US Who's Who in Religion, the Canadian Who's Who, and the most recent edition of Men of Achievement. And he's also appeared on several major radio and television networks.
Your host for the next hour will be Guy Lee.
Good evening, Tom.
Good evening.
Good evening. Tom, your book, The Pagan Christ, is a challenge to what you call the literalist view of Christianity. I was wondering if you could help us to understand the distinction you're making here between being a Christian, which you say you still are, as opposed to being a Christian literalist.
Yes, I think it's an important distinction to make, because I believe that in terms of origins, Christianity began as a movement which was spiritual in its nature and esoteric in the sense that its doctrines had to be explained, and they were inward rather than exoteric, which is out there and sort of in the literal world. By literalist, I mean someone who takes the text of both the Old Testament and the New Testament as if they both were historic documents, and takes the Gospels, for example, as a historic account of the life of a historic person named Jesus of Nazareth.
Right, and I think I follow you there. So it's quite revolutionary in some ways what you're doing, isn't it?
Well, it is in terms of the situation today where literalism has been peaking for some years and is at the moment, in my opinion, threatening to drown Christianity completely. But it was not always so. At the beginning, the Greek theologians like Clement of Alexandria and Origen, St. Paul himself earlier, took the stories of the Bible in an allegorical fashion, in a mythical fashion, in a symbolic fashion, and saw the inner spiritual meaning. I mean, St. Paul says the letter, that is, literalism, kills, and the spirit gives life. So I think it's a very important distinction that should be made.
Of course. I mean, it's quite shocking in some detail, isn't it? It's going to, some people may well think, you're going on about the origins and historical mistakes and blatant falsehoods in the Bible. Tom, I'd like to take a look at some of the points you present in this book, if I may, please.
Yes.
Okay, thanks. First, let's take a look at the term pagan. Now, there seems to be an almost binary distinction drawn between what is Christian and what is commonly called pagan, okay? But in your book, you break this down by pointing out it's in essence, all of it is in essence pagan. Could you please elaborate on this to some extent?
Yes, I think it's important again to make an examination of the terminology. The word pagan had a very innocent meaning originally. It meant someone from the country, like a paisano in Italian, and had a reference to country ways and to folk religion. In the mouths of the early Christians, once they began to literalize the ancient mythology, it became a pejorative term, a term of reproach, and has remained so ever since. But unfortunately, people are unaware that most of what the Christian church took over and claimed for its own had its origins in so-called, quote, pagan roots.
Sure. Is that because basically Christianity, I guess, chose to usurp the original
what it called pagan origins and what you call pagan roots, i.e. building of churches around standing stones in the United Kingdom, for instance.
Yes, that's a very good example. Or building the St. Peter's Basilica on the site, on the Vatican Hill, on the site of a temple of Mithras, who was a very strong contender and antagonist of early Christianity.
Of course, he was the pagan saint or god of Roman soldiers, I believe, Mithras.
The Iranian god who had slain the bull and so on. But he had 12 followers and had a Eucharist or Holy Communion and baptism and so on.
Oh, I see. That's fascinating. Now, one of the authors you reference frequently in your book, The Pagan Crisis, Alvin Boyd Kuhn, and you present one of many interesting quotes by him, which says, "Long after Egypt's voice expressed through the inscribed hieroglyphics was hushed in silence, the perpetual relics of Hamitic, that is Egyptian, wisdom with their cryptic message utterly lost, were brought forth to the world by parties of ignorant zealots as a new body of truth." Could you tell us what, in your view, was lost from this ancient Egyptian wisdom?
Well, what was lost was the truth that echoed right through it and through the mystery religions, through the teaching of Plato and the Platonists and the other great teachers, Pythagoras before that. The great truth that the divine spirit dwells in every one of us, that the Christos, or the Christ, is something internal to every human being, that God has come in men, not gender-wise, but in human beings, not in a single man.
Of course. Would you say it's going to be more, it should be better looked on as an ongoing tradition, which whose traces were picked up by, relatively speaking, contemporary Christianity and adopted as its own? Would that be a thrusting theme of
your
book in some ways?
Well, they picked up the doctrine of incarnation, but limited it to one person, that is to Jesus.
Yes.
So you have in John's Gospel, the Word is made flesh, the divine Logos, which was a concept known to the whole pagan world, especially to Philo, the great Jewish-Greek scholar who wrote so much about the Logos. That was the principle by which the whole of the world was, the world and worlds were created. In John's Gospel says that became flesh in one person. And that, I think, was a huge blow to Christianity because it excluded everybody except this one man.
It is very exclusive, isn't it? And the literalists, or I call them fundies or fundamentalists, they hate the mention of Philo, don't they? They say, oh, he was a false prophet and all of that. They ignore the historical record and the literal record.
Absolutely, yeah.
In many respects, I would say. In your chapter, Christianity Before Christianity, you do quote one of the early church fathers, St. Augustine. And
yes.
You said the very thing which is now called the Christian religion existed among the ancients also, nor was it wanting from the inception of the human race until the coming of Christ in the flesh.
Yes, a lot of people, Christians, don't know that saying, but
really?
It is true that he felt that there was indeed a Christianity that wasn't called by that name right from the beginning, and that Socrates, for example, was as fine a Christian as ever lived.
Do you think, and now this is something I've often thought of myself, Tom, would it be acceptable, do you think, to rephrase or re-term Christianity, all this older belief, as divinity? I know we have the word divinity, which means God or Godhead, doesn't it?
Yes.
Could it be borrowed to encompass the earlier origins?
Well, what I say in the book and what I research in the book is that the concept of divinity within, which is what we mean by incarnation, that's the root meaning of the word, is extraordinarily ancient. And Egyptologists, for example, Siegfried Morenz, says we can speak of an Egyptian religion which has one fundamental point, the reality of a God who is in man, yes, as well as above man.
Within.
And that's the divinity within.
And this is where the literalists would call, the Christian literalists would call, the heresy of Gnosticism.
Well, yes, that's right. And the Gnosticism was the main enemy of the literalizers in the early days. And because they were the losers eventually.
Yes, they were, yes.
They have got a very bad press. And
yes,
if people call you a Gnostic today in Christian circles very often, they mean it as a term of opprobrium and disapproval. But
absolutely. I mean, I've heard that the Coptic Christian churches are the closest that mainstream Christianity comes to Gnosticism. I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, I think there's some truth in that, yes. But, I mean, if you take a man like Carl Jung or someone, and some of the most brilliant people of our time, I think you would classify them as Gnostics. Certainly the Gnostics were the theologians in the early church before they were hounded out of it. They were among the brightest minds.
Tom, you mentioned that there was a long list of religious figures that were born of a virgin. Now, what to you is the significance of virgin birth?
Well, the significance of the virgin birth is to convey the idea of very, very great specialness. It's a coded way, if you like, of saying, here comes divinity. And it was widely believed about many, many figures in the ancient world. In fact, some of the early Christian apologists point out to the fact that people shouldn't be surprised that they talk about a virgin birth for Jesus, because they said to the pagans, many of your own deities also had supernatural birth. So, I mean, it was admitted by the early church that this, in fact, was a widespread belief.
It does follow, doesn't it? I mean, as I mentioned earlier, and you know, as you quite rightly agreed, that hence the churches felt the need to encompass and take over the original holy places of these earlier religions and traditions.
Yes, it's particularly noteworthy in the case of the mother and child figure, the Madonna and child. I mean, that's probably a central icon of Christianity, Mary and baby Jesus. But in actual fact, the prototype of that is was millennia old at the time of the birth of Christianity. Isis and Horus,
right,
were the Madonna and child. And as a matter of fact, archaeologists have very great difficulty in parts of the ancient ruins in trying to determine now whether the mother and child image they're looking at,
yes,
is supposed to be Christian or whether, in fact, it is the earlier Egyptian.
That's fascinating. And, in fact, this has never been denied, has it?
No.
Because it
can't
be.
There's a deep connection. And modern Egyptologists, while they may not agree with everything I say, certainly agree that there's a very strong connection between Isis and Horus, her child, and Mary and Jesus. I mean, even the one of the topmost Egyptologists, Eric Hornung, in his book The Secret Lore of Egypt, comes out and acknowledges this very boldly.
It's almost heretical, isn't it, in terms of what modern where modern science meets conventional Western religion. I would say, you know, it does seem to be that way. I mean, I don't know. Have you any idea what the Coptic churches in Egypt, how they view this? Because it's their own tradition, after all. Do they try and marry the two at all? Do they try and marry the Egyptian, the modern day Egyptian? Is it the Egyptian Coptic Church in Egypt?
Yeah, they have huge numbers of similarities with Egyptian mystery religions.
Because they must do, mustn't they? And also maybe the Ethiopian. I don't know about Ethiopian.
But that I'm not so certain about.
No, they look on their place as being the Holy Land as opposed to the so-called Promised Land. This is very interesting because it does lead one down all sorts of avenues of thought here.
It's huge.
My friends have, a friend of mine read The Pagan Christ, said it was absolutely intriguing, the sort of lines of thought that you go through, and you can evidence everything there. I mean, it's there in the historical and literary record, isn't it? And you also point out, Tom, that there was rather a long list of religious figures that experienced death and resurrection. You mentioned Osiris, Horus, Krishna, Bacchus, Orpheus, etc. What to you is essentially the symbolic significance of this mythology of death and rebirth? Is it a recycle?
Yeah, well, it's fundamental to all mythology, the death of the old self and the rebirth to the new. It had to do both with transformation in this life and to... it also referred symbolically to the deep belief that this life was not the be-all and end-all by any means, but in actual fact, an interlude, if you like.
Yes.
Well, some of them believed it was a testing ground, but anyway, one in a series of lives, and that the death of every one of us was going to be followed by our own resurrection or Easter.
Because that trace of that is left in Christian fundamentalism, isn't it? To be born again, but they don't mean it like that. But it's like they've borrowed this concept to form
their
own...
Yeah, that's right. They act as though they invented it.
Their own tradition.
But in actual fact, it's very old and very common in all these religions.
Yes. It goes right back. I mean, it's really lost, isn't it? One doesn't really know when it started. I mean,
what's the
earliest examples, for instance, of the cross archetype? You write about that. And you've got the meaning of the cross as a universal symbol that you refer
again,
to.
Yes, most Christians in the literalist churches, in fact, most Christians, let's not just limit it to literalist churches, most Christians, period, are quite unaware that the cross is one of the most ancient archetypes known to humanity, and it's found in various forms all over the world, certainly in the ancient Vedic religion, which was older again than perhaps even Egypt.
You think that's even older, do you?
I think it could be. That's as arguable. But certainly they had this in common, that the cross, it came, I believe, originally from astrology, astronomy, from the actual crossing over of the solar power, the sun, crossing over the line of the equinox in the spring. That was a fundamental concept. And, of course, it lies behind not only the cross, but also the idea of Passover, and Christian Easter is pinned on it as well.
Yes, and these ideas have come down. It's almost as if, before even the so-called early church fathers, the little band of, should we say, apostles, and they don't even know whether it's the apostles actually wrote the so-called gospels.
No, they do not.
They may have been written 150 years after events, if those events are as were depicted. And it all seems to muddle through with faction upon faction, arguing, disagreeing, different sects. You mention a rather disturbing fact about the Emperor Constantine, who is widely, traditionally, given the plaudit of having started the Holy Roman Empire.
Well, he's kind of a pivotal figure, of course, because in 325 of the Common Era, he called all the bishops together because he was very concerned for the unity of his empire. He didn't care really much about theology deep down.
No.
And to the right to his dying day, he remained a worshiper of Helios, the sun. He went back after Nicaea, got an agreement on the Trinity, which reconciled the various warring factions and gave him a basis of unity for his empire. He returned home and proceeded to slaughter, and not particularly, it's not a nice way to slaughter people, but he was particularly cruel in slaughtering certain of his own members of his own family. He refused baptism until his deathbed because he wanted to make sure that all his sins would be forgiven.
I see. So he wanted to get a complete sort of deficit built up.
That's right. So he wasn't going to take any chances.
So really this was a political move, very shrewd, I suppose.
Very shrewd political move. And of course,
yes,
it gave the bishops, who were in a mood to do a little persecuting themselves.
They were power brokers at the time, weren't they?
Yeah,
really?
That's right. But it gave them the power and backing of the might of Rome.
Yes.
To do what they wanted to do.
Why do you think? What was it that gave the spread of Christianity, if I may ask? What gave it its momentum? Was it the same force of belief that, for instance, in modern day, I forget the name of the sect who thought the alien mothership was going to land and they all committed suicide?
Oh, yeah.
Is it the power of belief?
I can't comment on that particularly, but...
Was it Paul just being the ultimate sort of...
The times were chaotic. Times were very chaotic then.
Yes.
And, you know, some people paint this idyllic picture of the early centuries of the church, but
no. It
was nothing like that at all. There were all kinds of warring sects and beliefs, and
yes. People
were very concerned about the possibility of an apocalyptic end to everything. They were concerned about their own personal immortality. And by dumbing down the faith of Clement and Origen and the earlier fathers, the spiritual fathers, by dumbing it down and making it literal, they were able to bring in the ignorant masses in large numbers, and especially when they had the backing of the emperor. And it was helpful to be seen to be belonging to the Christian church.
Now we're just pausing for some exciting news about astriamagazine.com. Stay with us. By the way, don't forget to grab your own copy of our fascinating 40-page Astria magazine. Just visit our magazine webpage at www.astriamagazine.com and download it for hours of fascinating enjoyment. And do visit us again soon, because astriamagazine.com is full of fresh news, information articles, free audio interviews, your very own copy of the latest issue of Astria magazine, and also we have a message board if you want to leave your own news or discuss some of the articles with other people from across the internet. www.astriamagazine.com.
They were able to bring in the ignorant masses in large numbers, and especially when they had the backing of the emperor, and it was helpful to be seen to be belonging to the Christian church.
Sort of Disney comes to church, almost.
People flocked in.
Yes. I can see that, and I see someone like Paul being a sort of saying, you shall not do this and you shall do that, which was, his Pharisee origin. So obviously he wasn't at that council. I believe...
No, it was later, much later.
Yes, absolutely. I believe even the Pope didn't actually attend the council. Is that correct?
Well, it's a very highly questionable whether there was such a thing as a Pope at that time.
Maybe there were several.
The whole romantic idea of Peter and a continuous succession of bishops of Rome dating down to the present is something historians argue about,
of
and rightly so.
There is a section of the book where you give a number of examples of the wholesale destruction by the Church of Ancient Knowledge in the form of books. What, in your view, was the greatest threat to the church contained in such earlier writings that they destroyed? I mean, how would you weigh the historical damage that was caused by that destruction of by the church of the books to the overall development of culture that was handed on down through the ages?
Well, there was a huge loss because of the book burning that went on, not just the library at Alexandria, but many, many other treatises and works by distinguished thinkers. I mean, the Gospel of the Egyptians, we know of its existence, but that it existed at one time, but we know also that it was destroyed, and it would have been very interesting to have seen the evidence in it, no doubt, of the way in which the Egyptian faith was, in fact, translated into a new form that eventually was adapted by the church. But really? There were commentaries on the Gospels by Basilides, who was a great, great brain thinker, that were destroyed. And they were, of course, they destroyed many works on which were philosophical, which were medical, books on astronomy. One of the reasons for the Dark Ages, as a matter of fact, was the widespread destruction of learning by in the name of Christ, unfortunately. And it wasn't until the Middle Ages when the Muslim conquests carried and brought with them some of the classical works that learning really broke out at the Renaissance.
It triggered what we call the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
Although, ironically, Islam has never had such a Renaissance in its own right, it would seem, although it did have that early awakening.
It had that brief time of flaring brilliance, and anyone who has looked at the architectural work done during that period.
Oh, it's fascinating, isn't it?
Has got to just marvel at it.
The sheer, we had nothing to match that in the West.
No, we haven't. It's astonishing. So I think that, in a sense, many Muslims today rightly look back with nostalgia on a time when they culturally were leaders in the world.
That was their high season,
or the high
wasn't it?
Points, yes.
In historical terms and in cultural terms as well, I suppose. Also, Tom, you write at length in The Pagan Christ about the numerous connections between Egypt and Christianity. You do mention that Gerald Massey had assembled over 200 direct correlations between Egypt and Christianity, such as the star in the east.
Actually, these 200 points of contact were points of similarity between the Christ of the Gospels and Horus, the son of Osiris and Isis, in the Egyptian mythology.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because, I mean, we won't go through them all now. Readers will have to read your book to learn more about what you're saying here. But, for instance, Horus walked on water?
Yes, that's right, and stilled the storm. Horus opened the eyes of the blind. And they made the dumb to speak, and anything that is in the Gospels, from Jesus being tempted to the raising of the dead, Horus did it.
Tom, going back to Horus, is it your feeling that the Gospel of the Egyptians, which is presumably a lost Gospel, is from where from whence the other Gospels drew their inspiration? Possibly.
Possibly. We don't know.
We just don't know, do we?
No, just a question mark. That is.
I mean, at the end of when Jesus, the figure, if there ever was such a figure, because there are scant references to such a person historically, as far as I know, died and his followers were dispersed, would it be likely that perhaps some of them went into Egypt and this is where the first
It's not impossible, but in the book I set out how, in my own research, I think that the Egyptian influence came through Judaism on the one hand. The Old Testament is very heavily influenced by Egyptian
thinking, undoubtedly.
You know, and then it came also through Greek religion, and so there was a kind of a synthesizing going on between Platonism, the ideas of Pythagoras and Plato and the Neoplatonists on the one hand, and the ideas of the Messiah kind of thought, messianic thought on the part of the Jewish. I mean, early Christianity may have originated as a form of mystery religion in a Jewish version, so that the taking over of Egyptian themes and motifs, I think, was mediated through the Jewish and the Greek ancestry.
I see. So there's a marriage of almost, you could say, possibly, three different sources: Egyptian, as you say, Egyptian, Judaic or Jewish, and Greek.
Yes, you see, the name Jesus is Yeshua in Hebrew, which means, as you know, Joshua. That name Joshua, of course, is in what we call the Old Testament, hundreds and hundreds of years before any Jesus of Nazareth. And so that was a very common thought. There was an expectation in some quarters in the first century that Joshua would return.
Right.
And at the same time, there were Greek-based worshippers of a kind of a Christ form of religion, and the two could well have come together as Joshua Christos, or Jesus Christ.
Would you say that it's the Greek influence which gave the, for want of a better word, the movement of Christianity in those days, its mystic flavor on top of everything?
It is a form of mysticism.
It gave it its packaging, didn't it?
Yes, in the Egyptian form, it's Hermetic.
Right.
After Hermes, that's the form of mysticism that it took. And it's interesting to me that at the center of every religion today, when you look at the mystical core of it, whether it's Islam, Sufism, or Christian mystics, or whoever, they all begin to look very much like each other and sound very much alike. Mystics of one faith understand the mystics of another, because at the core of all religion, I think the same truths hold true.
Yes, I mean, if you look back, as you say, it does add up there. What modern-day Christian might call, you know, in the blessing, the peace of God, which passes all understanding, a Hindu, a Muslim, I would venture a Buddhist, can feel that same peace.
Absolutely. The Hindu believes in the Atman, which is the soul within, which is part of the divine soul.
Yes.
I, as a Christian believer, believe that part of the divinity, part of God resides in me and in you, which I would call the Christ in us.
Indeed.
Someone else in another faith will call it by another name. The name doesn't matter. One of the messages of my book, in fact, the central message really is that we can go beyond the differences of the various faiths today, and while keeping any differences that we want, we can recognize beneath that we are metaphysically, or if you like, theologically or spiritually all the same. We are one, deeply
and
one.
Indeed, and we have the same spiritual instinct.
That's
right.
There's
no getting away from it, is there?
For a divided world.
I mean, people ignore it and turn away from it, but we do all have that. And as you say, a world divided by man, in all his petty endeavors, I suppose, if we could only find what lies within us. And of course, Christianity, literalist Christianity, that's why it hates ideas and beliefs such as Gnosticism so vehemently, because it sees Gnosticism as such a threat, even today, as it did in the early days.
Yes, it does. In fact, the unfortunate thing about literalist Christianity is that it's very divisive. It immediately divides the world into them and us.
It's bipolar, and, isn't it?
You know, when you get Christian fundamentalism and then Islamic fundamentalism, and then Jewish fundamentalism, and the three of them are meeting in the so-called Holy Land, the potential for a world conflagration is very great. So we're talking about serious issues here.
Well, I believe it was Napoleon Bonaparte once stood above the Vale of Jezreel when he was over there and commented, he said, all the armies of the world could maneuver here. Maybe prophetic words, who knows?
Well, let's hope not. I mean,
absolutely.
In the book, The Pagan Christ, I argue for a spiritual or symbolic or allegorical understanding of Armageddon, and believe that Armageddon is the battle that each one of us fights daily, because we are a blend of spirit and matter, or animal and spirit, and we're constantly engaged in what St. Paul called a warfare, which is really an Armageddon. It's not something that's coming tomorrow or in the future, but it is something that we wage day by day.
Within our hearts.
In our own hearts, yes, and lives. And judgment is now. Some people think judgment is a day of judgment off in the future. Judgment is right now. We are being judged daily.
Indeed, indeed. And Tom, moving on very quickly, this is an aside to this discussion, but in light of contemporary events with the passing of Pope John Paul II, today we've got the cardinals are having their conclave. Yes. Where do you think that leaves Christianity worldwide? Because the majority of contemporary Christians are Catholic, Roman Catholic, I believe, in numerically speaking, especially if you count up in South America.
Yes.
What sort of effect do you think it's... I mean, is he going to be made into a sort of cult figure? They're almost going to worship him as a passing god.
Well, you'd think from the television coverage, especially if you watch CNN, if you can stomach it long enough, I can't. But
I'm afraid I'm allergic to it.
Yes, if you believed that, you'd think that this man walked on water and was the greatest pope who ever lived. With all due respect, he is not.
He's a man.
And was not.
No.
And has left the church in many ways in a great state of crisis because of his centrist and monarchical view of things.
Yes.
He was a great talker, but a very poor listener.
And a very poor administrator, apparently.
And that's
well.
Right. The internal affairs of the church are in a disastrous
absolute shambles.
Because he gathered around the world all the time, and the Curia in Rome was not made very public, but it wasn't a well kept secret either. They were very upset because things were not getting done that should be done because he wasn't there.
No, do you think the next pope is likely to be an Italian? I mean, some talk about a black pope, you know.
I think that's premature personally. I mean, who knows? Nobody knows. I was in Rome for the election of John Paul II and John Paul I, and for the death of Paul VI. But nobody knew then, even though everybody had their expert opinions, nobody knew what was going to happen. And both elections then were a surprise, and I think it'll be a surprise this time. But personally, I would hope it would be an Italian pope.
For what reason? Because it's going to
draw things together better. For a number of reasons. I think they understand. They're very wise in administration, and if there was one of the more forward-looking ones chosen who wasn't too young, I think it would be in the best interest of the church. He could reign for 5, 6, 7 years and let things settle out, but at the same time begin to ease up in certain areas where they need to.
Where they need to. They say that he's picked men of his, you know, his own mold, so to speak, that he had chemistry with. I don't know how true that is, but
I don't think anybody who makes predictions knows what they're talking about personally at this time.
Sure, it's too early to tell, isn't it? Because you know, they're going to go on and on. And Tom, if I can ask you, where does all this leave you as a Christian? Everything that you write about in The Pagan Christ, what do you think the future direction of Christianity should be?
Well, I think, you know, the more scholars look at the New Testament, at the Gospels in particular, the more they fall apart when you treat them as historical doctrines.
Certainly.
One of the Jesus Seminar scholars, a man by the name of Professor Robert Price, has written a book not too long ago called The Deconstruction of Jesus, and another book called, by the same man, Price, The Incredible Shrinking Son of Man. Uh-huh. And his point is that Jesus Seminar scholars who have reduced what Jesus is supposed to have said down to about 18% of anything in the Gospels, and what he's did to about 17%, he thinks they're much too optimistic and that they actually don't have grounds. It's like peeling an onion down until the center disappears. Mm. So that's what's happening, and I think that intellectually the church is going to have to come to a more spiritual understanding.
Is it perhaps going to have to look at accommodating some of these so-called lost gospels, possibly? Because there are a lot more sayings attributed to Jesus in those that are never even acknowledged.
Well,
they're regarded as heretical.
I think that unless they say the miracles of the Gospels and the other stories have to be seen as the really the stories of the evolution of our own soul,
allegorical, really,
of each one of our own journeys.
Yes.
Unless they see it that way, keep plugging away that it's literally true. Ultimately, people will be turned away and lost.
Indeed. Well, Tom, that is most interesting. Just before we leave, could I just mention that you've got another new book on release, The Spirituality of Wine. Can you please give us a brief description of this?
It's such a nice book.
you enjoyed writing that?
Yes, I did. The Spirituality of Wine. It's absolutely, you know, I can say it's absolutely gorgeous because I didn't take the pictures and I didn't do the layout. I can't claim credit for any of that. But it is a beautiful book because it just is full of such lovely color photography.
Go on.
Yeah, it was a delight to write, and it's filled with rich quotations. I mean, you know, I don't know. I like wine, and it's a celebration of it.
Are the pictures white, red, and sepia?
You see, it was spiritual. I mean, wine is the most, the vine is the most commonly mentioned plant in the whole of the Bible.
Sure,
and
it's
part of all ancient religions.
Yes.
Every ancient god figure, man god figure, changes water into wine.
It's a symbolic.
Yeah.
It's the birth, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And it's symbolism tremendous because it's the new birth, the transformation of life, taking the matter of life and turning it into spirit.
Oh, of course.
It's a kind of an alchemy, if you like.
A spiritual alchemy, almost, one could argue. Well, an alchemy with a hint of more than a hint of spirituality, more of a tone, more than just a tone, a hint.
Yes, well, it's deeply, deeply symbolic of the changing of the base metal of our lower nature into something higher and more beautiful for God.
Of course. Now, Tom, I'd just like to say thank you very much. You've been a fantastic guest here, and thank you for discussing your bestseller, The Pagan Christ, with us. We do hope you'll be back sometime very soon to visit us soon, okay? And for anyone who'd like to know more about Tom Harper and any of Tom's many other books, you can visit Tom's website at www.tomharpur.com. Tom, lastly, when will The Pagan Christ be available? I believe it's not available in mainland Europe yet, or the United Kingdom. Do you know?
It's available in Holland and in Germany, and soon to be in Greece. But we are still waiting to sell the UK rights.
That's good. And for any readers elsewhere, they can go to in the United States and in Canada. It's available in good bookshops and also at Amazon, yes, as well?
Yeah, Amazon.com will get it.
That's marvelous. Tom, thanks very much for visiting with us. And
I've really enjoyed it, and good
pleasure.
Wishes to all your many, many, many guests.
I'm sure they return it, and I'm sure people will be fascinated to read The Pagan Christ. All the best, Tom.
Thank you, Guy.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of this show. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed it. Do join us regularly for all the latest ideas, news, reviews, and discussions, and free audio downloads, all here at Astrea Magazine Web Radio. You'll right-click to Knowledge and Discovery. You might also want to download our feature-packed Astrea magazine. Astrea magazine has got 40 pages of high-quality articles by well-known authors, scholars, and progressive thinkers, and it only costs a trifling £3 sterling or a couple of dollars or so. Simply purchase your download via our secure, protected PayPal system, and it's yours to print out and keep. We're sure you'll have hours and hours of enjoyment and fascination reading Astria magazine, so just go to our magazine page and grab your very own copy. www.astriamagazine.com